My name is Don Nicholson.
Mr. Nicholson, where were you born?
I was born in Bertel, Manitoba, Canada, on the 10th of August, 1921.
Is that a province, a town?
Yeah, Manitoba is a province because in Canada they have provinces versus states in the United States.
How big was the...
A very small town. My mother was on vacation in the summertime out there because my oldest sister was matron of the hospital that I was born in when I was born. And so I was born in Bertel, and then after my birth I was taken back to Winnipeg where I was raised and went to school in Winnipeg. My father was a caretaker in a school in Winnipeg.
And when did you move from Winnipeg to the U.S.?
I've got to get this straight. Okay. What happened is I didn't move down to the United States till, of course, after the war was over and I was back home and... served for a long time in the Air Force in Canada. And on my retirement, I moved to Brandon, Manitoba, and expected to be retired there. And the two fellows approached me there and said they were going to open a restaurant in America, and they wanted me to manage it. And it was to be a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant. I didn't know anything about chicken or restaurants, so I went to work in Brandon, Manitoba at the restaurant there, a KFC restaurant, and I think the pay was $1 an hour in those days. And to find out what happens in the restaurant when the manager isn't there, because I didn't know anything about managing, so I figured if I found out what happens when the manager isn't there, it'll give me a boost.
We'll back up now, and I'd like to know, where did you go to high school?
In Winnipeg. I left Kelvin Technical High School when the Second World War was declared.
Did you graduate?
Not completely. I was out in the 11th grade, and I left and then decided to enlist in the Air Force because the country was at war, so I enlisted in the Royal Canadian Air Force. And I thought I was going to be a straight air gunner, but what happened is after Manning Depot, which is where you go to learn the basics of marching, etc., they called out a draft of pilots. And so when they called out the names, and they were short 4 people, so they just said, "You 4 at the end of the line, fill in." And I was one of those 4. And so I wound up going for pilot training. When we started off going to, fortunately for me, one of my friends was a school teacher, and when we went to Brandon, Manitoba to start our training, it was a ground school, and I thought I'd never get through this, but this fellow tutored me at night because we're all confined to barracks anyway, so he tutored me at night, and he got me through all the stuff, and I went on and went overseas to England. I went to Sutton Bridge in Lincoln.
First of all, how long was your training, military training,
in Brandon, Manitoba? I think it was about something like about 6, or in Brandon it was about a month or 6 weeks.
And that was everything there?
Yeah, and then we got uniforms, everything else, and then we had to go on out on guard duty at isolated places that they were building airports and Air Force bases, and so we were used as guards until they had a draft of pilots ready. And I was sent out to West Coast. And in those days, we flew in Tiger Moths, twin wing, small aeroplane. And we were taught how to take off and land. And then we were sent solo. And when they sent us solo, there's a 4-foot red ribbon taped on the tail of the airplane as a warning to all other aircraft. This was the first solo. Everybody keep clear.
What was your first solo flight like?
It was quite thrilling and a little scary, but, you know, we just go on from there.
Is there a length of time on that solo flight that you're supposed to be up?
No, it's just more or less was just to do some circuits and landings. And once you could do the landings, that was the important thing. Then we were sent off to Dauphin, Manitoba, then to fly AT-6s, which was a low-wing monoplane. And they we spent a number of weeks doing that until we graduated, and then we had a wings parade where we were given our wings. And then we were immediately shipped overseas to England. And, of course, we went by boat. You didn't fly over in those days.
How long was your ship voyage over to England?
Oh, it was probably about, I can't remember offhand, but it was probably 10 or 11 days.
How many people on the boat?
Oh, heavens, it was loaded because we had bunk beds on the decks, even, or so, and we were on bunk beds until we arrived in England.
Was there plenty of food for 11 days for that many people?
Oh, yes, we had enough food.
And the
mess hall, yeah, it wasn't bad. And we were all fired up to get overseas anyway, you know, you're young and foolish.
Where in England did you
port? Sutton Bridge in England. And we were converted to Hawker Hurricanes then.
What's that?
That's the name of an aeroplane that was the precursor to the Spitfire, which is the famous Spitfire the British had during the Second World War. But just prior to the Spitfire, they used Hawker Hurricanes, and that was used in the Battle of Britain, too, with the Spitfires.
So were you in England for
A few weeks. I was in England for a few weeks until I graduated from what they call OTU, Operational Training Unit. That's where we had where we learned to fire the guns and that sort of thing, and in the aeroplane. And then we were shipped by boat to Africa, and we landed in somewhere in Nigeria, I believe it was, and we went then by aeroplane DC-3 across to Khartoum in Cairo. Oh, it was a couple of weeks. It was a long trip, but
was it again a full ship?
Oh yeah, it was a troop ship. All troops were moving into the and so because at that time you see Rommel had pushed the British back to Alexandria in Egypt, which is just north of Cairo, and so we went by air. We flew in a DC-3 from Nigeria over to Khartoum in Cairo, and then up to Cairo from Khartoum. And what I was doing, excuse me, at the time I was sent then to a ferry command, which was ferrying aircraft up to the front line to get ready for the Battle of El Alamein. And there was four of us Canadian pilots, and we were to take four planes up this one day. And we landed and at the airfield up in near Alexandria, and we got out and threw our parachutes over our shoulder and going to hitchhike back to Cairo to get the next one. Then they stopped at the gate and said, the commanding officer wants to see you four fellows right away. So we were four Canadians, and we went over to see the commanding officer, and he told us that we can't go back to Cairo because the Battle of El Alamein starts tomorrow. And one of the squadrons is short four pilots. It was 450 Royal Australian Air Force Squadron. And this was on 239 Wing, and a wing is comprised of a number of squadrons. And so we had about six squadrons in that wing, six or eight. And
how many in a squadron?
A squadron would be, well, what we would do is we flew as a squadron, there'd be 12 airplanes. I mean, we had more airplanes, but usually flew 12 at a time, or, you know, somewhere near there. And then there's so many squadrons to a wing. And so we started off, and this Australian squadron, they said, it's just temporary, you just do this until some more Australians arrive over, and then you'll be sent back to you. But by the time more Australians got over, we had lost some aircraft. So we didn't get back. We just carried on four Canadian pilots on an Australian squadron all across North Africa and into Malta, Sicily, and Italy.
What was that like, working with the Australians?
Oh, they're a wild bunch. Those Aussies, they were a wild bunch, I'll tell you. But they were pretty good guys, though. And we had a number of losses, of course. And what we did is we used to have to, we didn't use cash, we used everything's charged in the club, you know, the officers' club. Well, we just had a pilot's club, and it didn't matter what rank you were, we all lived together in this Australian squad and the pilot's club, and we had to charge. But then what happened is a couple of fellows got shot down, you know, and killed, and so the commanding officer figured, well, this is a tough thing. We can't very well send a bill to the parents of someone who just lost their son. So what we decided we'd do, we'd all put so much money on payday into the mess hall and to the bar, and that then they would deduct everything we bought from it. And then we had an agreement with all of us that if any of us got shot down, then the rest of the guys could use up the balance of that bar bill for a party that night. And because it was sort of eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you're going to get knocked off, because we had a lot of losses. But anyway, we got through until an interesting thing. We got to Sicily in Italy, and we hadn't been to Sicily very long, and the wing commander one day called me on the phone, and he told me I was to report to his office right away. He wanted to see me, and of course my immediate thought was, what have I done wrong now? And so I headed over to see the commanding officer, and he said, the wing commander, and he said that he had just been up to Catania. He says, by the way, do you have a sister in the military? And I said, yes. And I said, she's a nurse in the Army. And he said, do you know where she is? And I said, no, sir, she's overseas somewhere. And he says, well, she's at Catania, because her ship was bombed in the harbor here, and they had to get off, and so they've set up the hospital in Catania. And he said, and it's just up the road. So he says, you take my motorbike, and you go up and see your sister and say hello, and then you come right back, because I need my motorbike. So I did. And
how was your sister?
Oh, she was fine. Oh, yeah, they were wearing Army battle dress, because they'd lost their uniforms and everything when the ship sank, was in the harbor down, when the ship went down. So but they were all bright and cheerful, you know. And of course, there's so many losses in the hospital, and they had you know, patients, army patients, laying in cots in the hallways, even, you know, and the nurses were just going round the clock. So
see that she was okay.
Oh yeah. So she was 4 years older than me. So she's always sort of been my big sister and looked after me. But anyway, so we had a wonderful time with them for a while, and then we found a Cant 100, an Italian airplane, a two-seater. It was something similar to our Tiger Moth. And so our ground crew fixed it up so it could fly. So we painted the crosses off it and put roundels on the thing. So we flew it, and then we could take the nurses up for a ride in the airplane, which is highly illegal, I guess, at the time, but we did it anyway. And so then we went over to Italy, and we went up to Bari. And when I was up in Bari, they called for a squadron, and we didn't have a full squadron of aircraft. We only had six serviceable aircraft, so they picked the six oldest pilots with the commanding officer, and we had to fly over to the other side of Italy to go after a German column that was heading north to Rome. So we had to dive bomb and strafe it, because we've had Kitty Hawks, P-40 Kitty Hawks, and nothing could face Kitty Hawk, because we had 650 caliber guns, and a 50 caliber bullet is a big bullet, it's a big shell, and so nothing would face that. So we used to strafe trucks in the road, and it could blow them up and everything, you know, and do a lot of damage. And we carried a 500-pound bomb under the belly. And so, to cut a long story short, we made a mess of the convoy heading up, and we were running low on fuel. So the commanding officer said, we'll go over to the beachhead here, the Anzio beachhead, where the army had landed. So we went over to land there, and I went to lower my undercarriage. Only one oleo leg came down because it was jammed. I'd been hit by ground fire, and but that, you know, that could happen.
Could have been worse.
Oh, well, yeah, I'd been shot down. We were doing escort to some bombers, and we got jumped by some Messerschmitts, and I was one of the ones that was, there were eight of us shot down, and 13 Messerschmitts shot down in that one battle. And, but it was behind the line, so I took off, and during the night I headed towards the coast. And the next morning, at first light, I noticed some people, Arabs, their women were out gathering little bits of roots and grass from the rocks where they do overnight. There'd be little sprouts grow. And so they took that, and they took me into their camp. And I didn't know whether they were, you know, for us or against us. But what had happened, they were Muslims, and they had been accused of stealing. They were working for an Italian military camp and were accused of stealing. And the Muslims took offense at that because they don't steal. And so they left en masse and moved out into the desert. And so when they found out that I was working for the Allies, they were thrilled. They thought that was great going kill the Italians, you know. And of course the women all wear veils because they all think women are all the same from the neck down, that just their faces, their facial features are different. So the second day the women took their veils off, so I thought, that meant that I was accepted. So I slept in the tent with the chief and his daughter. She was about probably 8 or 9 years old, but she was all still painted up, you know, their faces with marks and tattoos and things. And they don't bathe. The Arabs in the desert, something like the Eskimos up north, they don't bathe, so it's hard to be close to them. And so about the third day, we heard some rumblings, and then we see some dust coming. And so I was disguised as one of the Arabs, and so I stayed in the tent with just my eyes showing. And I stayed there while I told them to go, and then we saw these cars coming. We didn't know what they were. They were armored cars, but they were all painted, you know, in desert colors, you know, so they couldn't be seen from the air, and camouflage. And all of a sudden we saw a jeep come down, and we saw the roundel on the hood. And so I signaled to the Arabs to stop that one. So they ran out and made held up in front of this jeep to get him to stop. And it was a British warrant officer. He was standing up in the thing, and I can still hear him to this day. He's saying, "What the bloody hell," you know. And so then that's all I needed to hear, in that English accent. So I came running out and started peeling off my burnous and all my stuff, and dangling my dog tags.
I'm here.
Yes, so he called the lead armored car, and he came back with a lieutenant in it, and he checked my ID, and then he radioed it back to his base, and they sent it back, because then they radioed back to Canada, to my parents, because they had already sent a telegram, you know, that the Air Force officer, casualties officer overseas regrets to inform you. And so they sent a priority signal back saying that your son has returned to his unit safe and unhurt, you know, so
great relief.
That sort of thing. But
that's
it was quite an experience.
Yes. Can you tell us, Mr. Nicholson, about some of the people you worked with, you met during the time in the service? Any special characters that stand out that...
Oh yeah, there's some of them are real characters. The Australians were a wild bunch, though, I'll tell you. They were, and there were only the four Canadians on that squadron, and we never did get replaced because they lost. The last time I was shot down was when I had to go on belly land it, and I flipped over on my back, because the oleo dug into the ground and the beachhead. And so then I was tour expired, because I was on an extended tour of operations, because in those days you only had to fly 29 missions or 200 hours. But I had been granted on a second tour because I was still healthy and all. So
they needed you, yeah.
Yeah, so it was... So then we came back from Sicily, moved back to... moved back to Sicily, and then to North Africa. And then I was sent back to Cairo, Egypt, from North Africa, because... I was sent as an instructor at a flying school there, for fighter airplanes, teaching students.
How long did you teach over in Cairo?
It was a number of months. And then they had various, in Cairo, they had various places for us to rest, you know, because they had what they called Canada House in Cairo, and they had in the New Zealand House, and you know, all these various allied, the American House and all things. And so I went up to Canada House in Cairo, and as I was going up the stairs, I saw this beautiful pair of legs going up before ahead of me, and I arranged for the hostess, Mrs. Stewart, who was the hostess of Canada House, to get me an introduction with this nurse, because I was quite taken with her. And so, to cut a long story short, we got married in Cairo, a military wedding, and it turned out that we didn't know each other for long, but it turned out that we were only born 18 miles apart in Manitoba, in Canada.
What a coincidence.
I know, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. What are the odds of that happening?
Yeah. And my wife, of course, outranked me because when we met, I was a second lieutenant and she was a first lieutenant.
What was that like?
Well, what happened was we would get together on weekends because she was working. She was one of the 300 Canadian nurses that were loaned to South Africa during the war because they were short of nurses for their military hospitals. So she went down to South Africa. And she went by boat. There's 300 of them, and they left New York and were 32 days at sea, out of sight of land, for 32 days until they arrived in Durban, South Africa. And then their hospital, because they were on loan to the South African military service because they'd been sort of their own nurses. So then they moved up to Cairo when they were going to start the big offense, you know, when they were going, everything was going well. So I met her when in Canada House. So we were married. And,
how long after you met her did you get married?
Oh, heavens, only a matter of weeks.
Uh-huh. Good. How long have you been married?
52 years, and I lost my wife 4 years ago to cancer, so.
52 years, what a milestone.
Yes, and it was absolutely wonderful. Yeah.
Sorry about
that.
Yeah. Hi. Hi, John. Can we stop that for a moment or not?
Sure. Okay. So how long were you in the service from the time that you...
Well, from the time I went, when I enlisted, 1941, I guess, late 41, and then I got out in 1945, I think it was, when the war ended. And,
so 4 years.
Yeah, and then I went back to my work in the newspaper in Winnipeg, and then I decided that I was going to move to Ontario. We moved down to Toronto and then moved up to Haileybury, a small town in northern Ontario, and opened a grocery store. And I was going to do that. And while I was doing that, I saw in the paper where in North Bay, which is a city, the biggest city up north in Ontario and Canada, they had a new commanding officer, Stocky Edwards, and he was one of the pilots, one of the aces during the war, was on another squadron, the same wing that I was on. And so I went down to see him and visit him, and he asked me how I was doing, and everything, and the next thing we know, he said, you should come back in the Air Force. We're short of pilots, and we need pilots, because at that time they're building up for the Korean War. So I went back in and stayed in, and then wound up as a flying instructor for a number of years. And then my last 6 years in the Air Force, I got the job of all jobs, because I was transferred to, I had to take a ground tour, so I was working in National Defense Headquarters in Ottawa, Canada, and I was an executive administrative assistant to an Air Vice Marshal, and so he came one day and he said that he's being transferred to Washington, D.C. as the Air Attaché. And then in the meantime, of course, I'd had a lot of helicopter flying too. So he told me that he was transferred. He was leaving for Washington D.C. and beginning a new boss. And he said, And my tour expired, and he said, I don't suppose you'd like to go back flying. I said, yes, sir, I'd love to go back flying. You know, I don't like the desk job. And so he said, well, Air Commodore Kerr told me he was looking for a pilot, a helicopter pilot. And so he said, I'll give him your name and see what he'll do with it. So I was transferred to, of all jobs, the greatest one of all, CP, Central Experimental and Proving Establishment in the Air Force up in Cold Lake, Alberta, which is a way hidden. And it's a big range. It's 40 miles wide and 100 miles long, and nothing can go in there. We had the range. We tested all the Sparrow missiles when they first came out. The Americans, they brought them up there because tested them up there. And so it was the last 6 years of wonderful years flying helicopters up there.
And that's what you did, the helicopter.
Yeah. And then I came back down to Brandon. I decided we'd never been anywhere near my wife's home since we were married. So my time was up in the Air Force, so we moved to Brandon, Manitoba, bought a home, built a new home, and was going to settle down, and I was going to look for a job. And at that time then my younger brother, who was living in Winnipeg, came out to find me. He said they'd been looking all over for me. They'd heard I'd come out of the service, and what they were going to do, they wanted to open a restaurant in America, but they needed a manager. And so he said, we've decided you should do this. And I said, I don't know anything about a restaurant, and I'm not too interested, but they talked me into it. And so they said, we'll pay you right now. So they said, what's the least amount of money you can get by with in a month? And I said, probably about $500. So he said, well, that's what we'll pay you, $500 a month. And
what year was that? You know?
That was 30-some years ago. And I'd have to look back in the calendar. And so I met this other fellow, and what happens, they got a franchise for the Kentucky Fried Chicken. And so we went to a little west of here, or east of here. I couldn't find a site, so they called the KFC and told them we can't find a decent site. So they said, we'll try Moorhead, Minnesota, and see if there's a place there. So we came to Moorhead and built the first KFC store, and then while it was started, then I went out to Cheyenne, Wyoming, and we opened the first restaurant out there, Cheyenne. And so then we got another one, and another one, and another one, and the first thing I know, we had 41 restaurants in 10 states. And it was a big corporation, and so 30 years ago we bought this building and moved here.
What was your final rank when you left the military?
Oh, I was flight lieutenant, which is equivalent to a captain.
That's excellent.
And I was commissioned in the field.
That's excellent. Do you have any final thoughts about what you went through while serving your country?
Not really. We, some little problem, what we used to do is we used to charge everything in the officers' club, in the pilots' club, and at the, and pay the year at the end of the month, we had to pay the bill. But then, unfortunately, we had two or three pilots got killed. And come the end of the month, and there was the bill was there, and so the commanding officer, we had a meeting with all of us, and he said, you can't send that bill to their parents. That's ridiculous. So what we will do is we'll switch this whole system, and we'll put so much money on deposit in the mess, the bar, for the month, and then you just deduct it. And then we decided, then we made an agreement that if any of us got shot down, then the rest of guys that night could drink up the rest of our bar bill, you know, on the house sort of thing. And that was sort of a thing between the pilots. We all did that. So when we lost somebody, we had a little party that night in remembrance sort of thing. And,
Mr. Nicholson, how would you like to be remembered?
Well, I have 4 granddaughters and 2 grandsons. I'd like to be remembered, I think, as a kind and gentle man.
Excellent. Anything else you'd like to share before we end the interview?
No, I don't think so.
Well, thank you, Mr. Nicholson.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Thank you.